It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Governor Scott Walker endorsed Ted Cruz for president today. We'll look at the significance of that and other political endorsements.
First, there's been a steady drumbeat of bad news over the last few years about retirement savings, with large numbers of Americans having little or nothing set aside for retirement.
Year after year, surveys come out showing large numbers of working-age families have no retirement savings. Nearly half of prime working-age families, according to research cited by our next guest. And even for people who do have money saved, a lot of them have less than $5,000.
Our next guest says this deserves to be a hot issue in the presidential race and that the candidates should be talking about retirement savings as a major crisis, but for the most part, they're not.
Helene Olin joins us now. She's a columnist for Slate and the co-author of the book The Index Card, Why Personal Finance Doesn't Have to Be Complicated. Helene, welcome back to the show.
Hi, good afternoon.
Well, when it comes to retirement savings, we touched on it briefly, but how badly are we doing as a country?
We're doing pretty badly. I mean, different people have different breakdowns, but the one I wrote about most recently came from the Economic Policy Institute, and they found that the average working age family, that is somebody between the ages of their early 30s or mid-60s, has about $5,000, a little bit less, put away for retirement. That's dreadful.
And you, when you wrote about this, you mentioned there are some small ideas coming from presidential candidates. What kind of things have you heard from them?
Well, the small ideas, most prominently is probably Bernie Sanders, who, and I should say on the Democratic side, there has been a lot of talk about upping Social Security. Bernie Sanders would completely eliminate the payroll tax cap, which is the idea that incomes are not taxed. I take that back. He would eliminate the payroll tax cap on incomes over $250,000. Right now, incomes over $118,500 are not taxed for Social Security. So he would eliminate that and use that to fund an increase in our Social Security paychecks, given that most people are fairly reliant on Social Security in their old age. Hillary Clinton has talked about raising the credits for caregivers and the amount received by widows and survivor benefits. On the Republican side, there's been much less discussion. Ted Cruz had a plan to open up the federal thrift savings, not Ted Cruz, I'm sorry, Marco Rubio had a plan to open the federal thrift savings plan to people without retirement accounts that he talked about in 2014 and hasn't talked about since. And otherwise, you have Donald Trump saying he would not touch Social Security, but that's about it. I should say the people who have discussed cutting Social Security most vehemently, that would be Chris Christie, Jeb Bush, are no longer in the campaign.
So even with the most talk about this, the things that you mentioned Bernie Sanders had proposed, is that a big difference maker for what you're saying is a crisis in retirement savings?
It helps, but it won't solve the problem. The average person right now, roughly, Social Security is at a little over 40% of replacement. People right now still, to a large extent, are benefiting from pensions and the growth in their housing, people who are retired now. That's not going to be true for the upcoming waves of people who are retiring. Younger baby boomers have much less than older baby boomers. Altogether, baby boomers are slightly more likely than not to be able to replace their income in retirement. Gen Xers, flat out, most of them will not, is what the data says.
And, Helene, you mentioned pensions a moment ago. That takes me to structural changes in how retirement works. I think a hashtag these days might be hashtag what's a pension. That's not really a thing for people anymore.
No, it's not. Pensions are what you used to get if you'd stayed at an employer for 10, 20 years. And at the end, they would, you know, when you left, you received, at 65, you received a stipend for life. That has, especially outside of the public sector, is almost unheard of now. The 401k was meant to came to replace it. It was never intended to replace it. The 401k starts in the early 1980s as a supplement to pensions. It is then expanded to cover everybody. It is meant to initially only cover high-earning people to put away, so they could put away some of their salary tax-deferred. It was assumed pretty much no one else would want to do that. It gets expanded to cover everybody. Companies begin to cut pensions. But as we all are probably familiar with in our own lives, saving is much easier said than done, especially when you live in an environment where things like healthcare, housing, and education are going up at rates well beyond that of inflation for a period of decades as salaries are stagnating. The result is people usually don't save that much.
Talking to Helene Olin, she's a columnist and an author looking at retirement savings, lack of retirement savings for many Americans. She says this is a crisis, maybe an emergency, wants to hear more from the presidential candidates. So, Helene, what would you like to see from the presidential candidates? What kind of projects, what kind of fixes could they be bringing to the table?
Well, I mean, it's going to be, you know, all sorts of things, but it's going to range from, you know, ideas to expand Social Security, potentially eliminating the payroll tax cap. If we eliminated the payroll tax cap, by the way, on Social Security, more than half, potentially about two-thirds and slightly more of the Social Security deficit would vanish overnight. So that would be a big piece of the puzzle right there. We're also beginning to see action in some of the states. California and Illinois are probably most far along on this, of setting up retirement plans that people without retirement accounts can invest in. There's some legislation in Washington as well, though that is not going anywhere, because, of course, nothing goes anywhere in Washington right now. But it has to be talked about. I think people need to be aware of the fact that most people simply do not have enough money set aside.
So what happens if all these people now who have no savings, can't build up that savings, hit retirement age and don't have that? What are we facing as a country then?
We are facing probably the first generations of elderly people where you're going to see huge groups of them living in poverty like you've probably not seen in several generations. People have this idea that, you know, prior to Social Security, that, you know, people happily took their surviving family members in and we all lived kind of like it was on the Waltons. And that simply was not true. You know, people had a distressing tendency to abandon family members when times were tough, old people in particular. And that's one of the reasons we have Social Security, actually.
So do people see this as a national crisis, or do people tend to think of this as a personal problem, you know, for my household or for some people I know, but not connecting it as a society-wide problem?
We live in a society where we tend to blame ourselves terribly for everything financial. I don't think this is a huge secret. And so I think people generally feel like it's their personal problem. Though I will say, you know, so there is immense support when you look at poll data for, you know, expanding Social Security or at least leaving it as is and eliminating the payroll tax cap when it is explained to people. Most people don't even know that that exists because, of course, most people don't earn more than $118,500. And we know that that's a huge priority for people.
So why is this something that presidential candidates aren't tackling more head-on? Why isn't it part of the political conversation, do you think?
I think there's a bunch of reasons. I think partly it's the power of the financial services sector. They kind of like things as is. So that's a big factor going in. I think it's also fairly complicated. It's not something, aside from arguing to raise Social Security payments, that's particularly easy to explain to people. It makes people uncomfortable. People tend to, and finally, I would say people tend to prioritize what's going on in their life now. So if you, say, are faced with childcare bills or college education bills or medical bills, that's going to be more important to you in the moment than a far-off retirement that we can't even visualize. One thing behavioral finance people have found is that we literally see ourselves as a different person when older. We don't actually think we're saving for ourselves, which is kind of fascinating.
We'll leave it there for now. Helene, thanks a lot for joining us today.
And thank you for having me on.
That's Helene Olin, columnist for Slate, co-author of the book The Index Card, Why Personal Finance Doesn't Have to Be Complicated.
Coming up, Governor Walker endorsed Ted Cruz this morning. We'll look at his choice and whether or not political endorsements matter to voters. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin's own Scott Walker, Paul Ryan, and Reince Priebus played a big part in crafting the public image of the Republican Party, but Donald Trump is threatening to derail what some have called the cheesehead revolution.
First, with Wisconsin's primary election coming up next week and with presidential candidates making appearances around the state to win over voters, many eyes have been on the governor to see who he'd endorse.
Governor Walker has made his choice. He announced his decision earlier this morning.
A lot of thought, a lot of time, a lot of prayer about this. Just really decided after all these years of the Obama-Clinton failures that it's time that we elect a strong new leader, and I've chosen to endorse Ted Cruz to be the next president of the United States for three simple reasons.
The governor went on to say he supports Cruz because he's a constitutional conservative, he can take on big government interest groups, and he believes Cruz has the best chance of winning in November.
James Wigderson joins us now. He's a columnist for the Waukesha Freeman and contributor to the website Right Wisconsin. James, thanks a lot for joining us.
Good to be here.
So not so long ago, you wrote a column saying that Governor Walker should endorse Ted Cruz for president, and he has done that as of this morning. Why did you think that Cruz was the best choice for that endorsement?
Because at this point in the campaign, in the presidential primaries, Cruz is the only one that can beat Donald Trump and actually still get the majority of the delegates before the convention. As much as that is a long shot, he still has a shot to do that, whereas John Kasich really had no chance to win Wisconsin, win any of the congressional districts in Wisconsin, and really would just serve as a spoiler and prevent Cruz from winning the state.
Now, we heard the governor there saying that he had to put a lot of thought and a lot of prayer into that. But was Cruz, do you think, in effect, the only decision that made sense for him?
Well, definitely. I mean, he certainly wasn't going to pick Donald Trump. When Walker dropped out of the race, he had made it clear that he wanted others to follow him in dropping out of the race to make the choice more clear between Trump and the rest of the candidates. Whereas he couldn't endorse John Kasich after John Kasich and Walker had two different approaches to Medicaid expansion, whereas in Ohio, Kasich took the Medicaid expansion money from the federal government. Walker rejected that plan, and he went his own way as far as how to handle the Obamacare expansion Medicaid.
No, we all remember when Chris Christie decided to endorse Donald Trump, stood with him on the podium. It seemed at that moment that there could be an embrace of Donald Trump from establishment Republicans. Was there any, though, a point ever for Governor Walker where that might have been the case, an option for him on the board?
I don't think so. He had made it pretty clear when he had dropped out of the race that he was definitely uncomfortable with the direction that Donald Trump was going to take the party. Also, Donald Trump had specifically criticized Walker's approach to how he had governed the state of Wisconsin. And so it made it very difficult for Walker to have made that leap into endorsing Donald Trump.
One of your columns in the Waukesha Freeman mentions how delegates are distributed in Wisconsin. Why would it be bad if the vote was split between Cruz and Kasich? What do you think is at stake there?
Well, the problem that we would have in Wisconsin is that it's not proportional. So in order to get delegates, you actually have to win a congressional district in order to get delegates, or you have to win statewide. It's really nine different winner-take-all races. One big one, and then the eight congressional districts. And so voting for Kasich at this point is really just taking away votes from the best shot at defeating Trump in any of the congressional districts or statewide.
What do you think about the question of whether endorsements matter? I mean, obviously, this has been something that has been watched carefully, who Governor Walker would endorse as a former candidate himself. But when it comes down to it, is it more than a political talking point?
Well, to a certain extent, it is when it comes to larger figures like Walker. Remember, Walker, as unpopular as he is statewide right now, he still has a 77% approval rating among primary Republican voters. So that right there is a factor. Plus, by endorsing Ted Cruz, Walker is making it a clear signal that it is okay for other Republicans to come out and support Ted Cruz as well. It's the same effect as when Tommy Thompson endorsed John Kasich. He made it clear to the people that used to work for Tommy that it was okay to come out and work for John Kasich and support Kasich.
Well, let's talk about that move. Is it surprising at all that you've got two, governors of Wisconsin, one president, one former, supporting different people? What do you make of that split?
Well, I think in the case of Thompson was talking about it today, about how he used to work with John Kasich, that they were part of the same administration at one point, that they have a long history together going back to the 1970s, back to the 1976 convention. So there's definitely some history between Kasich and Thompson, and I think Tommy Thompson takes that very seriously.
We are talking right now with James Wigderson, writer and columnist for the Waukesha Freeman and contributor to Right Wisconsin, talking about Governor Walker's endorsement of Republican candidate Ted Cruz. And in the Waukesha Freeman column, you wrote that Trump would fundamentally change the Republican Party, putting at risk two decades of work toward creating modern conservatism. But judging by the support that Trump has gained, what if voters don't want modern conservatism? Does Governor Walker risk being out of step with a major pillar of the Republican Party as it looks today?
Well, I think there's always that risk, but at a certain point, you have to be able to say what your principles are and what you're willing to stand up for. And certainly, Scott Walker is within the mainstream of the conservative movement in the United States, and certainly within the mainstream of Wisconsin conservatives. Donald Trump has no relationship to the conservative movement. He would fundamentally transform the Republican Party. He would make it more protectionist. He would certainly lead it in a direction on other issues. I've been joking since the beginning of the campaign, name one of the Bill of Rights that Donald Trump isn't willing to violate. I think that Donald Trump is going to take what was once an optimistic Ronald Reagan, Jack Kemp party and turn it into an ugly machine. And I think that it's incumbent upon Republican office holders to reject that.
Now, Donald Trump has, since this morning, been fairly aggressive in commenting about this endorsement of Scott Walker for Ted Cruz. He said, I think the quote is, he sent him packing like a little boy. He said he insinuated that he beat him, although they've never been on a ballot as such together. Does Governor Walker put, some sort of cabinet appointment at risk politically? Does he put himself at risk by supporting Ted Cruz, do you think?
Well, you have to start with the premise that there would be a President Donald Trump, and there's certainly no chance of that. Donald Trump is going to get beaten badly in November if he is the Republican nominee. You just can't have those kinds of negatives among women and independent voters and get yourself elected President of the United States. So in that sense, there's really no risk for Walker of missing out on an appointment. And in the off chance that Donald Trump does get elected president of the United States, any Republican office holder that would want to sign on to that kind of an administration, which is going to just be an awful mistake for this country, I think they would be ending their career right there. There are bigger and better things for Scott Walker's future than being part of any Trump movement.
What do you expect is going to happen on primary day here in Wisconsin? And do you think that Governor Walker's endorsement is going to sway voters one way or the other?
I think Scott Walker's endorsement came a little bit late in the process. He should have endorsed earlier in order to signal to the Republican establishment in the state that it was okay to accept Ted Cruz as the anti-Trump champion. However, I do think that Wisconsin voters, I think Charlie Sykes had it right the other day when he said there's a fundamental decency about Wisconsin voters. And I think that Wisconsin voters as a whole are going to probably reject Donald Trump. It's just a matter of whether or not up north Donald Trump gets Sean Duffy's congressional district delegates, or out west where Ron Kine is the congressman, and get those three delegates.
Now, there are scenarios that play out there. I'm sure you've heard them, that there could be a contested convention, that there could not be a Republican frontrunner at the convention, that maybe a third candidate could enter the scene here, a fourth candidate, someone who would unite the party from all different angles. Do you see that happening? And could Scott Walker or someone else, say, from Wisconsin, be a part of that?
Oh, sure. It's a fun time to be a political analyst. You can sit there and speculate on all sorts of things, and you have an equal chance of being right no matter which way you go. I really do think that the convention, there's probably a good chance that the convention is going to be contested. There's also a good chance that you may see a candidate that is not currently running being picked as the nominee just as a compromise candidate among all the delegates. I'm not sure who that would be. I don't think it would be Scott Walker just because he had been in it and had not done as well as people had hoped that he would do when he was in the presidential campaign. I think that there's a good chance, though, that they could pick somebody who should have done better in the primaries and didn't. Or it's entirely possible, too, that they may just coalesce around Ted Cruz. He's certainly doing a lot to make sure that behind the scenes that the delegates that are being selected are the type of people that would support him.
And what about Paul Ryan? You know, he's been saying, no, you guys, I'm not gonna do it. But on the other hand, you know, he said that sort of thing before.
Right. I think when I hear Paul Ryan say that, I always have that image of Jerry Seinfeld yelling, I don't want to be a pirate. I really think that in Paul Ryan's case, every time he says no, the party keeps saying to him, yes, and here he is, Speaker of the House, when he didn't want to be Speaker of the House, didn't want to spend that much time away from his family. He's certainly not wanted to run for president because of his family and what he's really a creature of the House of Representatives, not as much of an executive branch type person. However, you know, when the party asks, it's very hard to say no.
James, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
That was James Wigderson talking about Governor Walker's endorsement of Republican candidate Ted Cruz. He made that announcement earlier today on News Radio 620 WTMJ with Charlie Sykes.
Coming up, Donald Trump is shaking, as we've heard, the Republican Party's foundation, including principles promoted by Wisconsin's own Paul Ryan and Scott Walker. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talked to U.S. Representative Ron Kind about issues facing his constituents in western Wisconsin, from access to broadband internet to the opiate addiction epidemic here in Wisconsin.
First, 2011 saw Wisconsin Republicans front and center on the national stage. Scott Walker was in the first year of his governorship and had emerged as a national standard bearer for supporters looking to rein in the power of unions. Paul Ryan was gaining stature in Congress as the new chairman of the House Budget Committee, and state party leader Reince Priebus took the reins as chairman of the Republican National Committee.
They were laying the groundwork for a traditional conservative candidate who could emerge as the party's 2016 presidential nominee, with Wisconsin's profile rising all along the way. But then came Donald Trump. Trump and Ryan, for example, have clashed on numerous issues. Here's what each had to say in the wake of the San Bernardino terrorist attacks back in December.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on.
What was proposed yesterday is not what this party stands for, and more importantly, it's not what this country stands for. Some of our best and biggest allies in this struggle and fight against radical Islamic terror are Muslims.
Tim Dale is with us now for a look at the conflict between Donald Trump and the Republican so-called cheesehead revolution. He is chair of the Department of Political Science at UW-La Crosse. Tim, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, going back to 2011 and the beginnings of what both Governor Walker and Speaker Ryan referred to as the cheesehead revolution, what were the goals?
Well, so Wisconsin Republicans saw a lot of success with the goals of kind of mainstream Republican Party to decrease the size of government, decrease taxes, pretty classic Republican positions. And with the success of particularly Paul Ryan on the national stage, but also Priebus taking over the party, it really looked like the party was looking to expand in ways that were planned by what Wisconsin represented, which is a northern Midwestern state that typically elects presidents, but also can and has elected Republican governors from two different sides of the aisle. So Democratic presidential candidates have won in Wisconsin historically, but Republicans have had success both in Congress and congressional districts and the governor's mansion. The question really is about how a state like Wisconsin could be captured at the national level, and that's what that Wisconsin revolution was aiming for.
And how would you say that agenda was advancing at the time? How was it looking?
It looked very good, particularly with Paul Ryan being on the presidential ticket. And I think a lot of people would have been happy to see Ryan run for president this time. But instead, we saw Scott Walker, who for a period of time was the favorite of a lot of people. In fact, I think he may have even been the odds-on favorite to get the nomination for a while. So it was looking like it was going to be successful.
And so what happened? That agenda right now, those goals you just discussed, obviously in jeopardy with the candidacy of Donald Trump. Break it down for us. What do you think would happen there?
Well, it definitely was that Donald Trump happened. Priebus taking over the Republican Party was about trying to set a Republican Party agenda, both in terms of policy but also electorally, to make it more competitive in presidential races. And so in 2013, Priebus put together this project that was aimed at expanding the Republican Party base. How would the party appeal to minority voters, for example? How would it broaden its base of support in more diverse states? And Priebus was really given this kind of mantle of how do we build the party. And what Trump has done is actually moved the party in a different direction, where he's bringing in different voters who may not have been Republicans or identified with Republicans, but it's been essentially at the expense of some of the changes that Priebus wanted to see. Now, currently, when Priebus is asked about this, he says, well, we're excited to get new voters, and as the party chair, he has to have that answer. But it has moved the party in a different direction.
Can the Republican Party contain both, or are they contradictory and they can't exist side by side?
Well, because of the way we have elections in the United States and our two-party system, the parties have to be big tent parties. They have to be parties that contain within them diverse sets of constituents. And so it's possible because we have the parties that have to contain within it. But the problem is that in any one election cycle, you may have differences that become so extreme that it really alienates parts of the support. So this is what we're seeing right now on the Republican side, where important constituents on both sides are essentially promising not to support the nominee if it's not their person. That's never good for a party, although I should say that there are a lot of elections where we see that happen and then not actually come to fruition for the general election. So at least for that, it remains to be seen if the party can come together.
We're talking with Tim Dale right now, chair of the Department of Political Science at UW-La Crosse, talking about the split between the goals of Wisconsin leaders in the Republican Party and presidential frontrunner Donald Trump. And now earlier we heard a clip there of Donald Trump and Paul Ryan disagreeing about how to deal with threats of terrorism, but their differences don't end there. Here they are on Social Security and global trade.
Social Security. A cornerstone of financial security for millions of retirees, widows, and disabled Americans is going bankrupt.
All these other people want to cut the hell out of it. I'm not going to cut it at all. I'm going to bring money in, and we're going to save it. We lose a fortune on trade. The United States loses with everybody. We're losing now over $500 billion in terms of imbalance with China.
If we want to create good jobs, we need to make more things in America and sell them overseas.
And a clip there, Paul Ryan and Donald Trump disagreeing about a variety of things. Is there a middle ground for the two of these and the party in general to meet and have a consensus and a unified platform going forward?
Well, this is the problem that some Republicans have with Donald Trump, is that for a while now, the Republican Party has been the party of free trade. And it's also been the party of entitlement reform. And Donald Trump is messing up that agenda. And the problem is when a party has essentially an agenda that has been being built for several decades, and then the presidential candidate is not willing to stand for that agenda, the party agenda essentially shifts to conform to what the nominee believes. And so I think that there might be some middle ground. You may see some arguments coming out of the Trump campaign in a general election, for example, that might soften some of those things. But it actually looks right now like Trump would be unwilling to soften some of those positions. But that's also going to be a problem for a general election because of donations. There are a lot of big Republican donors that have fairly strong opinions about those things, and actually opinions that fall much closer to the Paul Ryan side of those debates than the Donald Trump side.
Looking back through the years via the lens of history, have we ever seen a schism like this within a party?
It has happened, and actually we've seen a lot more party fights than we've seen not party fights. And I think that the big schism that we see here that hasn't been in recent memory is the significant difference on so many policy issues. And what Trump has been able to capture is some alienation that at least the Trump supporters have felt in terms of not having their arguments or voices heard at the national level. So, for example, when you have both Democrat and Republican candidates for president advocating for free trade, there isn't space for some of the opinions that voters have. And so I think that parties have realignments all the time. Parties have positions that change given what voters demand. And I think right now we're seeing just a really pronounced example of that, and one that we may see have a significant effect on a fragmentation of the party, at least at the national level, for this election cycle.
Is this a massive realignment, though, or do you think it has the potential to be something even bigger?
It'll be interesting to see. I think part of that it was the reason why we're so interested to see how the next few months play out, and particularly the Republican convention. If the convention proceeds the way that the Republican chair Priebus would like it to proceed, there will be a presumptive nominee going into the convention, or at least a round of balloting that does not take the nomination away from the person who has the plurality of delegates. And then I think you would see emerging from that convention kind of a consensus choice. Even if it's Trump, there may be people who aren't happy about supporting him, but that are willing to do it. I think that the catastrophic scenario for the Republican Party is that convention is not only contentious, but it ends up completely factionalized, and so you might see another conservative party emerging from that tries to run against Trump. I think that's where you see something even bigger than just a realignment or just a Republican Party that starts paying more attention to trade or more attention to immigration.
Well, in the event that there is a candidate who's got that plurality that you were talking about going into the convention, where does that leave this cheesehead revolution that we've been talking about, this other strand of conservatism that was pretty different from what Donald Trump has proposed?
Well, I think that there's still a place for it. The Speaker of the House is probably the second most powerful person in the country after the president. And I think you have Walker, who still has quite a bit of credibility nationally and it's continuing to build that. And Priebus is the chair of the Republican Party, regardless of what party voters are saying right now in terms of their support of the project that he put together in 2013. So I think that the Wisconsin people who have gained prominence in the Republican Party aren't going away. And I think it's a really good way of thinking about the dynamics of the party right now, where you have people who don't necessarily agree with everything that Trump is saying, and how are those people who are essentially in charge of the party at the national level going to hold the party together with a candidate that doesn't agree with everything the party stood for?
Tim Dale is with us right now from UW-La Crosse, and we're talking about the split between the goals of Wisconsin leaders in the Republican Party, like Paul Ryan, like Scott Walker, and presidential frontrunner Donald Trump.
And we want to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. Do you think that Donald Trump is ultimately helping or hurting the Republican Party? Does his platform, do his views resonate with you, or do you feel more in line with the vision set out by Scott Walker, Paul Ryan, and Reince Priebus as part of what some have called the cheesehead revolution? If you're watching this from the inside of the Republican Party, what are your hopes and fears? If you're watching from the outside, what do you think? Call 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we pick up our conversation now with political scientist Tim Dale from UW-La Crosse. And we're taking a look at whether the cheesehead revolution of Paul Ryan, Scott Walker, and party chairman Reince Priebus has been derailed by Donald Trump.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Will the Republican Party emerge weaker or stronger because of these different approaches, different ideas? Do you feel that the party needs to be true to what have been its mainstream conservative positions? Or is it time for someone like Trump to shake stuff up? Call 800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@WPR.org or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Tim, I want to get to the callers because there's a lot of them. But first, you know, Donald Trump today campaigning in Paul Ryan's hometown of Janesville. Does that stop? Is that a logical one on the campaign trail, or is this kind of an elbow in the ribs to Paul Ryan?
Well, the way that the Trump campaign is explaining it is a logical stop, and it is a logical stop in the sense that Trump is going to be visiting areas that tend to vote conservative and have a lot of conservative voters, and so Paul Ryan's backyard is a place to go. Although, because there have been several pronounced disagreements between the two of them on some things, there is some interpretation that this visit in particular is the Trump saying that I am going to go to Wisconsin, I am going to go right to where these the cheesehead revolution happened, and I'm going to show you that I can win there too. So I think that Trump understands how significant it is to do well in Wisconsin, just as the people who are coming from Wisconsin are national party figures understands that the Wisconsin primary next Tuesday is really significant.
We'll take our first caller now. We've got Judy on the line in Appleton. Judy, hi.
Hi. How are you?
Good, thanks. What did you want to share?
I am voting for Trump. I'm hoping that he shakes things up. I'm switching over from the Democratic Party and going for the Republican votes this year because of Trump being in there. I think it's going to. I think that would be great if he would shake things up.
And Judy, you're saying what Donald Trump has said he could do, that he could bring voters in from the Democratic side of things. I appreciate you calling and sharing that with us, Judy. And Tim, what do you make of that? This is what Donald Trump has been saying. His appeal was broad enough to achieve, and Judy is evidence, at least one person evidence of that.
Right, and just as he's been getting some Republicans upset at his candidacy, he has been making arguments, particularly for some segments of the Democratic voting population that is appealing to them. I mean, I think it's telling that Reid Ribble, the congressional representative from northeastern Wisconsin, is actually one of the high-profile Republicans who has said that he will never vote for Trump in an election, and that's where your caller is from. So, I mean, it really shows how pronounced this divide is, where you have Trump gaining Democratic voters but then alienating some Republicans. It really is a fascinating development on the Republican side.
Well, Judy, appreciate that call. And next we're going to go to Tom in Eau Claire. Tom, hi.
Yes, hello.
Hi, what did you want to share?
Okay, fantastic. Well, Trump is definitely hurting the Republican Party. There's no question about it. But you know, the Republican Party has been bought by special interests, has been controlled by big business, and he's exposing politics in general for what they are, including the Republican Party. He's been playing it safe and somewhat treading lightly, but I think the time will come where he's going to really expose things much more than he already has exposed them. So, yeah, he's hurting the Republican Party, but they need a correction. Just like the stock market does a correction, the Republican Party and politics in general needs a correction. And I think he's doing a good job of exposing all the corrupt influences that are affecting politics in general.
Tom, appreciate that. Interesting stuff there, Tom. So, Tim, Tom saying that Donald Trump is just the strong corrective that the GOP needs. He's exposing some of the fault lines that Tom sees as needing correction. Do you think that's something that some Republicans are thinking?
I think so, and particularly in the sense that there are angry voters out there, and it doesn't mean that it's a majority of voters, but it certainly is a majority of Americans who disapprove of Congress, for example. And so there are voters who are angry maybe at both parties. So when we see Democrats crossing over to vote for Trump, you may see kind of the same phenomenon. And so I think tapping into the anger and dissatisfaction among voters is something that Trump is doing well. I think that's the big question for his campaign is can that anger be captured in a way that's productive in a general election, or does it become a campaign that is only about anger? And at least historically, those campaigns tend not to do well in general elections, but we've been surprised at several things that have been happening that are unprecedented, so this will be something that we'll be watching.
What are you thinking about how Donald Trump, if he's not successful, will change the GOP, the establishment GOP, the Paul Ryan strand of it, the Scott Walker strand of the GOP, because there is this maybe unidentified portion of the electorate now that we're aware of now. We know they're passionate. So how does that get incorporated if Donald Trump is not the nominee?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent and interesting question. I think particularly on issues like trade and entitlements, I think that you may end up seeing a Republican Party that over time, maybe even in the near future, changes its stances on some things. That is, if Trump is activating a portion of the electorate that hasn't been activated, particularly for voting for Republicans in a long time, then it's the Republican Party that might be saying, we need to revisit some of these positions. And that may be a way that Trump is going to affect the party if he's not the nominee.
Appreciate your call, Tom. And we're going to go next to Jim in Rice Lake. Jim, hi.
Hi. I'm just saying that the establishment Republican Party is getting what it created. In 2009, the Heritage Foundation, the Koch brothers, and the Republican establishment helped create and literally transport the Tea Party to create right-wing civil disobedience against the Affordable Care Act. And Romney and McCain were not their cup of tea. And now, literally, I believe that the dog has come off its leash, and the Republican establishment is responsible for what has happened. I'd be interested in your guest response.
Jim, thanks for that. And that's a narrative that you're hearing often from Democrats, but from others, too. Tim, what do you make of that?
Well, what's interesting about the cheesehead revolution we were talking about before is that running as an insurgent candidate is something that is rhetorically powerful. But the problem with gaining power is, that, ironically, that now you're in power. Now you're the establishment. And so someone like Ted Cruz, for example, who certainly wouldn't have been called the Republican establishment even 6 months ago, it now seems to be one of the remaining establishment choices, even though Cruz is essentially made arguments on the floor of the Senate that has called out the Republican leadership. And so I think this is where you have the phenomenon of Trump really going against this idea that there can be such a thing as an anti-establishment establishment candidate. Is it possible to be in power politically and make effective arguments against political power? And so I think that's where Trump has captured the imagination of anti-government voters who even anti-government candidates who are in government aren't persuading them that they should support them.
Jim, thank you so much for the call as we talk to Tim Dale right now from UW-La Crosse talking about Donald Trump and what he represents in contrast with the so-called cheesehead revolution, people like Scott Walker and Paul Ryan here in Wisconsin. And Tim in Green Bay, hi, what did you want to share with us?
Yes. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I will say that I think that Donald Trump is a breath of fresh air in this election cycle. And I'll preface it by saying that I think Bernie Sanders is also. And just by saying that each of them they're not standing on the politically correct, they're not standing on the establishment, Republican or Democratic side. And I think that many people are just tired of all the different things that are going on that make it where nothing gets done.
Tim, thank you for that call. Tim referencing the gridlock that we've seen in Washington in recent years. And what do you say to that? I mean, is there a parallel between Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders that represents something broader going on?
Well, this is something that political scientists are going to be studying for a long time. This is a historic election. And I think the caller points out something interesting. We actually find among Trump voters that they're just as likely to say their second choice for president is Bernie Sanders. And I think that shows just how much the anger at the mainstream party's positions on something like free trade actually shows Bernie Sanders to be closer to Donald Trump on some issues than Cruz or Clinton or Kasich. I think that's where you're seeing the electorate going right now is voting for anti-government candidates or anti-establishment candidates.
And Tim, as we wrap up, how important do you think Wisconsin is in the primary coming up on April 5th? And what do you think the message will be when Wisconsin hands a victory to either Donald Trump or Ted Cruz?
Well, Wisconsin is very important, and particularly on the Republican side. If Wisconsin hands the election to Trump, if Trump wins a majority, it's Trump going into the backyard of major party figures and saying, I can win there. If Cruz wins, it signals a turn in the race where Cruz might be showing I can win in other places in the country, and it becomes a real competitive election going into the convention. And because Wisconsin's the only primary on that day, the whole country is going to be watching.
Tim, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That was Tim Dale, chair of the Department of Political Science at UW-La Crosse. He joined us to talk about the battle between Donald Trump and Wisconsin Republican icons for control of the GOP.
Coming up next, we'll talk to Wisconsin Democratic Congressman Ron Kind about top issues facing Congress. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. News is coming up next on Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.